Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is co-sponsored by the Business and Leadership member-led forum, Kevin O'Malley, chair. Our program is The World We Create, a Message of Hope for a Planet in Peril. It is my pleasure to introduce Ralph Kavanaugh, co-director of the Natural Resources Defense Council's Energy Program. He will be our moderator for tonight's conversation, questions, and discussions. Ralph, welcome to the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you, Annette. Normally, when I'm fortunate enough to be summoned to the Commonwealth Club, it's to deliver the functional equivalent of an opening environmental blessing. I think this evening we will dispense with that, and I will content myself with giving you just a bit of context on the latest Bob Dean's Francis Beinecke collaboration, which you're going to see in action in a moment or two. What I like about this collaboration as a longtime part of NRDC myself is that I think it exemplifies some of the best traditions of the institution. We love and have since the founding of NRDC in 1970 had a particular weakness for gifted journalists and eloquent Southerners. And in Bob Dean's, you get both for the price of one, as you are about to see. With Frances Beinecke, I first met her when she was an advocate for coastal and ocean protection. And she went from that role into one of being the NRDC trustee, and not all of you know this, who oversaw and chaired the most ambitious restructuring of the institution that it's ever had to make. It brought it basically to the point where it could be the place it is in 2014. And she did that so effectively that there was no question who would become the first executive director of NRDC under that restructuring, and then who would become the president to succeed John Adams, who had been president of NRDC for 35 years since its founding. Frances will shortly be turning over the presidency of NRDC to Rhea Sue, who has strong roots in the Bay Area, and although she will continue to indulge the fiction that NRDC is headquartered in New York. But this is an opportunity for all of you to hear from Frances and Bob before she turns over the presidency, and to hear about a collaboration that began with a volume many of you remember from 2014, which really helped launch the national conversation about what the Congress would do about climate change. And they move now to a conversation about hope for the future. To let that conversation unfold, I will turn matters over to Bob Deans and look forward to getting your questions, which I will put to the panelists at the close of the program.
Thank you, Rob.
Carry on.
Thanks so much. As Ralph mentioned, I am from the Commonwealth of Virginia, which is why you might have seen me start to rise at the sound of a gavel. I don't know why that doesn't happen here, but it's a real privilege to be here at the Commonwealth Club, a place that has been inspiring minds and enriching lives here in the Bay Area for more than a century, so we're grateful to be a small part of that. And coming from Washington, it's always a great thing to come to a place where people know how to get things done, and no people anywhere get things done better than the people here in San Francisco, so we're really grateful for that. And of course, today is a particularly great time to be here in San Francisco. I mean, you can just feel the excitement out on the streets, and it was a comforting thing to know that no matter how much progress we make, no matter how far we go, there is still nothing that pulls together a great American city like an old-fashioned book launch. We're really great about that.
Very well done, Bob.
So to launch off Frances's book, I just want to start off by asking you a question, Frances. At this juncture in people's career, often when they turn to a book, they reminisce, they look back, they reflect in something like a memoir. In this book, you were determined to tell a story that has more to do with tomorrow than yesterday. How come?
Well, first of all, this is a collaboration between Bob and me, and Bob wanted this to be a reminiscence, and I am much more focused on what we have to do looking forward. So What I wanted us to do was really look at what are the challenges of today, particularly in the context of climate change, and what are the actions that we collectively have to take to advance to a clean energy, carbon neutral future. So we told the story of a lot of trips that we've taken together to really witness the catastrophe of fossil fuel development, production, and transmission across the country, and then the opportunities that are out there with clean energy and how they are being unleashed. So I think there is a lot of hope out there, but there's only hope if we take action. This does not happen by itself. It's not happening quickly enough. And the book is really about why we need to accelerate as quickly as we can to a clean energy future.
I want to ask you a little bit about the title, The World We Create, A Message of Hope for a Planet in Peril. You cite 3 points of hope that you have in the book. One, you talk about the president who understands the stakes for the country. Two, you talk about the widening business community that understands the opportunity. And three, a new generation of environmental stewards who sort of understand the urgency of the moment. Tell us why you find hope in those three places.
Well, first of all, I think that the key word in the title is we, because what after 40 years of being in this field and lots of expertise, lots of solutions only happen with an engaged public. And, you know, if anything has been made clear to me, particularly over the last decade, and in the effort to get legislation on climate change, which we were not successful in, I think probably everyone in this room knows that, in 2010, that we need a much more engaged public, both in looking and developing and unleashing the opportunities, but also the call for action. So I'm hopeful because I really think that in the last few years, the level of engagement has really gone way up. And it's gone way up for a variety of reasons. One, I think the understanding, comprehension of what climate change actually means is growing clearer every single day to people in their own lives. This isn't a computer model. It's not abstract. It's not a future generation. It's us. And so people understand that and want engagement and activism, and we're seeing more of that. But also people are engaged in the solutions. I mean, I'm on an advisory board at MIT. It's probably the most hopeful thing I do, to go up to Cambridge. I'm sure if I was out here, I'd be doing the same at Stanford, but I happen to be going to MIT, where there is an entire student body engaged in what are the innovations of the future, what's the technology of the future, and I find that incredibly hopeful. I mean, I go to Washington, D.C., spend a lot of time, maybe too much time, and it's challenging to be hopeful when you're there because you're fighting a fight and you're doing it with great intensity. But you go into these college campuses, whether it's a campus that's organized around divestment or it's MIT or Stanford with a huge technology investment and lots of engaged students, and you come back from that and you go, you know, we can do this. This is something we can do. But we have to get focused with great intensity to accomplish it, because what we're trying to do is completely transform the energy sector of the world. That's a pretty big undertaking, and it has a very embedded industry. The fossil fuel industry is very embedded for over a century, has everything kind of designed for them to move forward. So to actually shift that to different industries, to efficiency, to renewables, to innovation, to technology, is just very, very hard to do. So I do have a lot of hope, but I also am driven by the need for engagement. It's just critical.
You mentioned the importance of connecting these to the lives of people. It's not just about policy. It's principally about people. And you do that in the book with a lot of stories, and you start with one from your former roommate, Sigourney Weaver, who wrote in the foreword an interesting story about the two of you going after a beaver dam in the Adirondacks. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, first of all, this was a long time ago, and I have to tell you why I have to tell you that part. So we're very good friends. We both go to the Adirondacks probably in the 70s. You know, we have a pond, and these beavers made this dam, and I've since learned over 40 years that they make the dam every year, but this was the beginning of my experience, so I thought, you know, we're going to get rid of that dam, so let's go undo the dam. So ripping the dam apart, the water starts
And because to flow. Why, Francis?
What?
And because why?
Well, because we wanted to really save the shoreline. I mean, the trees, this was this is an area that had been logged, and the shoreline actually was an area that had not been logged, and it had great pines and cedars, and I didn't want them to be flooded by the beaver dam. So so Sigourney describes this in the book, and you know, it was a fun thing to do. It actually made me realize that, you know, you have to do it again and again and again. And that's very emblematic of my career. You're redoing. Everyone at NRDC, you know, this is a continuum. Even if we win a fight, we're fighting it again shortly enough. So the beaver dam. But the funny thing is, so Sigourney writes this in the foreword, and I recalled the story. I thought it was really great. And then the NRDC attorneys take a look at it, and they go, you know, isn't there a law in New York that you can't pull out a beaver dam? And I said, well, if there is, I don't know about it. But in any case, we gave it to our legal counsel, who Mitch Bernard, many people here know, who said, doesn't anybody here have a sense of humor? I think we could put this in the book without worrying that someone's going to come after me for ripping out that beaver dam. But, you know, those beavers almost extirpated. Now they're back doing their job year in and year out. And I think that's what we do. We do our job year in and year out, fighting the fight to protect the environment.
Now, you open the book, Francis, with a story about a very hot June afternoon at Georgetown University, and you've gone to hear President Obama talk about the need to protect future generations from the hazards of climate change. Tell us about that and why it was important enough to you to open the book with that story.
Well, we've been working for 15, 20 years with great intensity for the last 10 years for action on climate change. And California, as you mentioned, is on the cutting edge of this issue, has put in place important laws and implementing them and really showing the nation the way. But we need to do that at a national level. And we had tried in 2010 to get legislation, and we hadn't succeeded. But the urgency gets greater every year. And so throughout the Obama administration, we had been working very hard to get action at the federal level. And after the 2010, we still needed action, and we needed the president to lead because we recognize getting something through Congress is very, very difficult. So on June 25th, 2013, we all went to Georgetown for the president's climate speech. And it was a real moment because we were focused on one very important aspect we're working on now, which is to get carbon emissions from the power sector, 40% of the emissions, to be controlled under the Clean Air Act. That was sort of our focus. But the president, in a 45-minute speech on a very hot day that was so hot that the teleprompters didn't work. He was using the teleprompters and then looking down. We tried to figure out what is going on there. It was like 95 degrees. We're all outside. And for those who use teleprompters, they don't work in the heat. Maybe you're not going to be using them, but I think that was it was interesting. But he laid out the most comprehensive program across the federal government. The centerpiece was the carbon pollution standards under the Clean Air Act, but every single agency across the administration was charged with a climate strategy that they had to implement. So the Interior Department, the Energy Department, the Military, the Defense Department, the Ag Department, and it put them on notice that every means available to the federal government would have to be utilized to address the very urgent threat of climate. And so it was a moment we had waited 5 years for, and it laid the pathway for our advocacy for the next 3 years through the end of the administration. So it's very, very important and exciting because this is something we had really worked hard for. It's not the result, it's just the beginning, but sometimes it takes a long time to get to the beginning. So it took us a long time, but we're there, and now we're across the institution. We have well over 100 people working on aspects of that climate strategy to make sure that it gets adopted during the course of this administration.
Now, a few days after the BP oil blowout in April of 2010, Francis went down, and talks about this in the book, went down to the Gulf of Mexico. You met with oystermen like Byron Onclenade out on Barataria Bay, went out on the boat with him to look at what was happening to his oysters. You met with environmental justice people like Derek Evans over in Mississippi, and you flew out in a helicopter not once but twice over that spill. And I remember on the second time we returned, looking at the gas gauge, and there was precious little gas left when we were coming back in over the Delta, because Francis had insisted that we continue circling the spill.
That's not what happened.
At about 40 miles at sea. And
okay,
let me finish one thing here. When we landed, I said to Francis, did you realize that we were down to about 14 minutes worth of fuel? Because I didn't think she had any idea. And she said, yeah, I knew that. And I was watching the fuel gauge the whole time.
The whole time.
But I want to ask you why it was important to you. And some of you may not know this, but a couple of months later, President Obama tapped Francis to be the environmental voice on the President's Independent Oil Spill Commission, looking into what happened and what steps could be taken to make sure nothing like this ever happened again. But that was to be a couple of months later. Why was it so important to you to get down there, talk to the people who were being affected, look at the damage for yourself, and how did that shape your vision of this disaster?
Well, early on in my career, I had a great mentor whose name was Harold Jerry, who we were working actually in the Adirondacks at the time. And he gave me very good advice, which I followed the whole time, which is if you're working on something, you really need to go see it. Don't be at a distance. Understand what you're talking about. So when the oil spill happened, and we had no idea at that point how big this spill was, because we were just in the early days, and it went on for 100 days. So Bob and I went down with another colleague, and we did fly out 40 miles. I'll tell you, 40 miles in a helicopter over the ocean is a long way out. And never go with a journalist, because you're out there, you're looking down, and it's the classic picture, all the boats, you know, trying to skim it, burn it, control it, you know, we're over the top, and then the pilot says, maybe we should head back. The journalists say, let's go around again, and I'm looking at the gas gauge, but we made it back, but by going all the way out there, we really both witnessed this sheen all over the water, which was very clear and evident and went for miles and miles. But we also recognized how very challenging it was going to be to control this. 40 miles out, 5,000 feet under the water, our entire oil spill containment program emergency planning was done around the premise that it's a tanker that spills near a port. I mean, that the entire design emerged out of the Exxon Valdez spill, which had been 20 years earlier, and this was completely different, and none of the protocols worked. And we're in the Gulf of Mexico, which is the base of the oil industry, and they were totally ill-equipped to deal with this. So, you know, it was very important for us to go down and see it firsthand. When we went out with the oystermen and went out, and they, you know, were pulling in the oysters, showing us how to do it, showing their homes, we were in the bayou. And as we came back, they were told that the oyster fishery was closed. So the one well and the drilling going awry closed the oil industry, the fishing industry, and the tourist industry literally across 5 states. So, you know, the impact was tremendous, and the oil industry, which was railing against the Interior Department for not allowing them to go back in, they shut themselves down. I mean, they shut down the other industries too. But this is an area that has been the workhorse of the energy sector for the nation. And that's the thing that I really felt when I went down there. I thought, you know, a tremendous amount of the oil resource that we use because of our own addiction is coming from the Gulf of Mexico. And we've just let that area be responsible for that and have the environmental impacts. And we haven't done the vigilance and oversight and monitoring that we should have. So it was a real learning experience and very sobering, because we really saw firsthand what the oil addiction is doing to an incredibly rich, the Gulf of Mexico is a wonderfully rich ecosystem that we also depend on too for its fisheries, and then those communities all along their shorelines, you know, were put in jeopardy. And these are communities. This is the other thing. These are communities that experience hurricanes on a very regular basis. They are very resilient. They respond to hurricanes. But the thing that was different for them, a hurricane comes in, blasts through, 24 hours later, they're all in recovery. Here was something that blasted wide open, and the uncertainty of 100 days, they never knew when it was going to be over. You know, they were, and we, I was in Alabama visiting with the mayor of Gulf Shores, and he had been out there literally 20 hours a day for weeks trying to save his community. I mean, you have to admire these people. They were really extraordinary in trying to respond to just incredible disaster in their lives. Amazing.
This is Ann Clark, and you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California Radio and our program, The World We Create, a message of hope for a planet in peril, with Francis Beinecke, president of the Natural Resources Defense Council, in conversation with Bob Deans, former president of the White House Correspondents Association and currently director, editorial content, NRDC. Our moderator tonight is Ralph Kavanaugh, co-director of NRDC's energy program. And I get to tell you that I grew up near the Gulf of Mexico, so it means a lot to me.
Thank you, Ann.
Thanks, Ann. I think one of the things you did with the book, Francis, that's unique is you sort of trace the arc of the cost that we're bearing for our addiction to fossil fuels from production areas like offshore drilling, all the way through to the cost that's being incurred by the consumption in terms of the threat to our climate. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about something you say in the book, that in 40 years of on the front lines of environmental advocacy, nothing has so antagonized and frightened and frustrated people across this country like you've seen from fracking now in more than 30 states. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what that means to you.
Well, I think what's happened, it's very interesting, really, and there's a positive side to this, too, which is where for, you know, I think certainly my entire adult life, you know, per my comments about the Gulf of Mexico, you know, we put gas in our cars, we flip the light switch, and we don't think that much about where any of this is coming from. It just happens to be there, and we use it, and that's pretty much the way it goes. And even though at NRDC, where we've been telling the energy story for a long time, it's hard to relate it in people's lives so that they understand it and feel that it's somehow connected to them. What fracking has done and the oil and gas boom that's happening across the country now, and we're, I believe, the largest oil producer in the world, at least I saw an economist chart yesterday that established that, it's taken energy development into the front yards of people all across the country. It's become very personal. And so, you know, whether you're in Pennsylvania or you're in West Virginia or you happen to be where oil trains are going or pipelines are being proposed, suddenly a good part of America, not just in the Gulf of Mexico or Oklahoma or Texas, but a good, or California, where there is quite a bit of energy development, but a good part of America is now finding themselves on the front lines of energy development, and one, they're quite surprised by it, and two, they're very unhappy about it because they don't feel they have much of a voice in these decisions. Now, there's a lot of work going on to try to change that. California has passed a law, Fran Pavley, who's the great champion for the environment here, to put in environmental safeguards. Our job is to be sure that those safeguards are adequate. In our view right now, they're not adequate enough, so that needs a lot more work. But I think that the good upside of this, and I'm a forever optimist, so I'm always looking at the upside, is this has engaged people in what is our energy future? What's the energy future that we actually do want? And so connecting what people don't want to what they do want or could want or call for is very important because we are not going without energy. We are usually reliant on it. We are here in this country at a much higher level than any other part of the world, but the whole world is dependent on it, and the developing world needs energy. So these are problems that have to be solved, and in my view, the more aware and engaged people are and concerned about the downside, the stronger advocates they're going to be for the clean energy future we're embracing. So I've actually seen that shift. I mean, nobody, you know, the voices about fracking concerns are not going to be diminished, but harnessing that concern to support for clean energy strategies, efficiency, renewables, smart grids, and all the other elements that are required is really, really important, because for those on the front lines of energy advocacy, and Ralph Cavanna is one of the great leaders in this, it hasn't been an issue that has garnered a lot of support from the public. It's incredibly complex, difficult. People don't really understand it. But now, if it happens to be going through, you know, oil trains through your town or fracking in Pennsylvania in your front yard, backyard, next to your child's school, suddenly this is an issue you care about, you want to be engaged in and have a voice in. So, you know, it's extremely concerning, but I think coming out of it is an opportunity as well.
One thing you point out in your book is the extraordinary amount of water that's being used for fracking, about 2.5 million gallons for every single well that's fracked, and there's a calculation in there that we've contaminated and locked away forever something like 750 billion gallons of water in the past decade for fracking. What does that mean in the context of a state like California that's going through an epic drought right now?
Well, I think there are a lot of choices about how water is used, and California is going to be very much on the front lines of making those choices because there's not enough water to be used for everything. And so one is to ensure that the way the water is used, the amount of water is highly regulated. And one of the very unfortunate things that happened in the early part of this century under the Bush administration is that the oil and gas industry sought variances to the major statutes, Safe Drinking Water Act, Clean Water Act, for the gas industry. This is before the fracking boom, but they obviously saw the fracking boom coming and had very good relations with the vice president at the time and were able to get these variances. This is extremely concerning because water is very much at the centerpiece of this. We need to reverse those variances, very hard to do in this political climate. So this is where state regulation is absolutely imperative to really get on top of this issue. And, you know, fracking is pretty much regulated at the state level at this point, and every state is a little bit different, and trying to bring some both uniformity and raise the standards across the board is absolutely critical, and we're trying to do that.
Now, Francis, another issue you go into are tar sands. A lot of Americans didn't know much about tar sands until we started learning about the Keystone XL pipeline, but you actually took a trip to Alberta, to the heart of tar sands country, some time ago, and what was interesting to me in the book is you met with some indigenous people there who told you many years ago that they were getting sick as a consequence of some of this tar sands development, and by the time the book was written, there was actual documentation from university researchers of spikes in cancer rates for these people.
The tar sands are in northern Alberta. Fort McMurray is the location, and we have people working on the boreal forest, and they came and told the story, and I think, I can't remember, 2007, 2008, I went up there with some colleagues, and you know, one of the things I learned in Alberta, and I learned it in the Gulf of Mexico, is the oil and gas industry has, you know, tremendous engineering prowess and really will go anywhere. And I mean to the ends of the earth. They will go into the deepest ocean, to the farthest reaches of the Arctic. This is something we're quite concerned about and trying to stop in the American offshore Arctic. But in the tar sands, you know, it's a major petrochemical operation in the middle of a wilderness, and at Fort Chippewa, which was a major fort on the Voyager's route, very remote. We had to fly in there. They have a winter ice road, I think, but otherwise the rest of the year, you know, it's either boat or plane to get you in there. And they have these off-the-chart cancer rates, and because coming down the Athabasca River into Lake Athabasca, and their diet is predominantly fish, they have very high mercury rates in those lakes and other toxins. And, you know, there are a number of doctors who've gone up and kind of studied these cancer rates, and it's just a complete anomaly if it weren't for the fact that they're right next to an industrial facility. So it's just shocking, in fact, to find such a remote place, really in a wilderness, where the people who've lived there for generations, millennia, are experiencing what you would expect to experience in, you know, an industrial hotspot someplace. And they're a distance from it, but, you know, the river carries all of it down into their food supply. So it was really tragic. And the other thing about the tar sands development, basically there's this very heavy viscous oil in the sand, so you have to tear the top of the trees, destroy all the trees, and then bulldoze up all the sand and then steam it all out so the oil becomes, refine it enough so that you can carry it down in a pipeline. It's a very heavy industrial process, and it creates three times the greenhouse gas footprint of regular oil. So one of the reasons we in the environmental community have been so focused on the Keystone XL pipeline is that as a symbol of making a choice of, are we going to be acting on the threat of climate change, or are we going to go business as usual or even a higher climate footprint, the Keystone pipeline is just completely emblematic of that. It's just the wrong choice, and we're very working very hard and hopeful that the president will deny that permit, and that will not happen. But the only way to really slow the development is to unleash the alternative, which is clean energy. So, you know, this is, again, a choice of all the attention to stopping something. That energy also has to go towards advancing the solutions, because we're very energy independent, and we will continue to be.
You tell a story in there about an Iowa farmer, third-generation Iowa farmer, who goes out in a blizzard in May to tend to his cattle, and he stops in his tracks when he hears frogs in his pond. And he says, there may be some places in the world where frogs and snow go together, but not Iowa. And he said, this is what climate change is all about, the wrong weather at the wrong time. Do you think that as climate change moves from being something that some people are hearing about theoretically into something that they just look out their window and see the manifestations of in their own backyard, is that the reason why 70% of the country now says it's time to do something to protect future generations from the dangers of climate change?
I think it is. I think that, you know, in communities across the country, for different reasons, I mean, everyone has a different experience, but there are experiences that are directly related to climate change. And, you know, we've done a lot of work, for example, with the Garden Club of America, and the people, mostly women, who were part of the Garden Club are out there year in and year out watching when seeds germinate, when things bloom. You know, they're kind of the front lines of seeing the changes that are taking place, or birders who, you know, go out year in and year out that same weekend to look at which warbler is coming through, and suddenly it's a different weekend. And, you know, those things are changing radically. You know, the habitat areas are moving, and it's just, I mean, first of all, I think that's tragic, but I also think connecting it to action is very, very important for people. And, you know, whether it's a drought in California, a couple of years ago there was a drought in the Midwest, in Norfolk, Virginia, where you're from, where there's a huge naval installation, sea level is rising around that. And, you know, one thing that's happened that I think is, people may have seen it just a couple of weeks ago, where the Defense Department, the military, is doing a huge amount of work on resilience and preparing for their installations that are being affected, and really focusing on what the security threat of climate change is. So it's really across all sectors. If you're in the agriculture sector, you're in the military, you're in the forestry sector, you know, you are, as I am, from New York City, and this is the second anniversary of Sandy, which completely devastated New York in a way that no one could have imagined. I mean, it was like out of a horror movie, 12-foot surge coming over, closing down hospitals, closing down subways. I mean, this is like you go to Hollywood to see something like this. But this happened, and all of Lower Manhattan was without power. Our office was without power. We had to move our servers out of the building to another location. I mean, but this is what people are experiencing, are these absolute, very consequential events in their own lives that they have never experienced before, and that is climate change. So I think one of the things that we at NRDC really want to do is connect the dots and also give people both a sense of what the solutions are, that there are solutions. You don't have to throw your hands up in despair, but the solutions that we see require engagement. And so that's what the book calls for at the end, is really engaging in the most powerful way as a voice for action.
I want to close with a question about that, because we've gotten some great questions from the audience. And I wanted to ask you, you do, as you say, you close the book with this great call to action, saying that we can, in this country, reduce our carbon footprint to the extent that we could actually absorb what little bit of carbon we continue to put out by improving the resilience, if you will, of our wetlands and our forests. And you say that we can become a carbon neutral country in our lifetime, which is a real call to action. And then just last month, you joined 400,000 of your closest friends in New York City with the largest march in history to call for exactly this kind of action. Tell us a little bit about what that felt like to you as someone who has spent four decades in this movement.
So the climate march in New York City in late September was a moment. I have said to many people, including on my Facebook page, that for me this was my own personal Woodstock. And maybe there are people here too young to remember Woodstock, but Woodstock was a big deal. You know, we have longed for a moment when people rose up on climate change. And leading up to that march, we have a young guy on our staff who was one of the organizers, and I was in the elevator with him, and Rob, you know, how many people are going to come to this march? He said, 500,000 people. I said, really? What I've heard is it's going to be, you know, 100, 125,000 people. And so he was the optimist. You know, I was, if we get 100,000 people, that's going to be extraordinary. That's going to be a great result. And then we go down to Manhattan from the Bronx where I live, and people are pouring into Central Park West where the lineup was, pouring. And, you know, they started giving you the numbers, and as the afternoon wore on, suddenly they're saying 350,000 people, 400,000 people. So the NRDC contingent, we were in the solutions group, and we stood for 3 hours before we could move. There were that many people, and we couldn't move. And it was just extraordinary. And the thing about it, not only the numbers, and the numbers were powerful, but the mood of this march was really important, I think. The mood was not anger. It wasn't, we're having a party, this is the greatest thing we've ever done, let's dance down the street. It wasn't that. The mood of the march was real resolve. I think everybody there really had a sense that this could be done, and that if we engaged in civic debate, civil society, action, democracy, that we can make it happen. And I really felt that. I mean, it was exhilarating for me. I was just so happy to experience this in my career, that what happened in 1970 with Earth Day, when all these people came out, that here we were in 2014 and people were coming out again, that level of engagement and understanding that it required voice to get the result was just a hugely important part of it. So I loved it. When we got to the end, the Javits Center at 5 o'clock, I was like, I want to keep going. Where can we march to? This is so much fun. So great. And, you know, I had my family with me. Many NRDC staff, you know, had their families, people, friends from literally who bust in from all over the country. Trains from California when, you know, I think there was a train from L.A., a train from San Francisco. I mean, people just poured in. And then, you know, people from around the world were there, too, because the target was the UN Climate Summit that was taking place 2 days later, where, you know, over 100 world leaders came to talk about what's the next thing on climate. And that was actually very positive, too, because there were a lot of commitments made. There wasn't an agreement, and, you know, maybe in hopefully in Paris at the end of 2015, the next big discussion among world leaders, there will be an agreement. But this actually showed the possible. There were over, I think, $200 billion of commitments from companies and countries to address various aspects of climate change. There were major commitments in reductions, in resilience, and adaptation. And so that was great. those were the companies and the countries that are making the commitment and on the cutting edge. But that really shows you why an international agreement and why a U.S. national policy is so important, because we can't accomplish the change that we seek if it's just the volunteers who are at the front lines and really understand this. It actually requires everybody. So I thought it was very hopeful because you had the citizen engagement and you had the models of what could be done, and now we have to weave those into actual agreements so that everybody has to participate.
This is Ann Clark, and you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California Radio and our program, The World We Create, A Message of Hope for a Planet in Peril, with Francis Beinecke, President of the Natural Resources Defense Council, in conversation with Bob Deans, former President of the White House Correspondents Association and currently Director, Editorial Content for NRDC. Our moderator is Ralph Kavanaugh, co-director of NRDC's Energy Program. We've now come to that point in the program for our questions from the audience, and we have quite a few questions. So, Ralph, I'm going to turn it over to you and Bob for our question session.
Thank you, Ann. As Bob and Francis know, there are no softball questions at the Commonwealth Club. I'm going to try to go through a number of provocative and important issues. In some cases, I'll be attempting to integrate several questions. Francis, I think in every case, the thought is I will put the question first to you, but I hope Bob will feel free to comment as well.
And also, we can turn it back on you, Ralph.
Yes, you can.
If it's particularly complex.
Several questioners are concerned that skillful misinformation campaigns were successful in blocking federal legislation on climate and continue to erode public support for the necessary changes. And the question essentially is, what's our counter?
What's our what?
What's our counter? How are we going to overcome that?
So I would just say that we are a lot more focused on messaging than we certainly were in the legislative process. We learned a lot, and we have organized, and the we is NRDC and a whole host of partners. This is an enormous undertaking across the environmental community. Many organizations are involved at the national level and at the state and regional level, and it is a joint effort. But one of the things that we are doing is a lot of research on where the public is. We're doing a lot of polling, focus groups, message testing, and then very quick responses. So, you know, we're very focused, particularly in target areas and target audiences, because, you know, we don't have the resources, certainly of the fossil fuel industry, to just broadcast. We've got to really focus on where do we want the information to be directed. I personally feel that in the last 6 months, we've really turned the corner on having the naysayers and the deniers be marginalized. I mean, they will not stop being deniers, but by always calling it like it is, that these are the deniers, here they go again, and going with, you know, this is about future opportunity for America, we're creating jobs, this is addressing a serious health issue, and really repeat on why this is an important thing to do. And, you know, I think we're just getting a lot more sophisticated at it. You know, I sort of see three legs to the stool. One is to have a policy proposal in place, the solution that we're trying to get, and we're very good at that. We have that. The other is to really focus on politics. In the end, this is a political fight. It's a state-by-state fight. It's trying to get build support in the states with key legislators who are both federal senators and at the state level. So there's a huge political organizing component of it. And the next part is people, really have an engaged public. Because what we have to counter the industry, the deniers, the naysayers, is voice. We don't have the money, but we have the voice. And that's why the voice is so important. So, you know, I think 5 years ago we would have put a bulk of our resources on the policy. Now we're putting, and it's much more equal. Chairs and stools not quite as lopsided. You know, we really know we have to invest in the politics and in engaging the public in a much more serious way to win. So that's what we're doing.
And I would just say quickly that one of the things Frances points out in her book is the enormous amount of resources that go to this industry every single day. 8 cents of every dollar spent in this country every single day goes to support the fossil fuel industry. 8 cents on every dollar. That's almost double what we spend on national defense. It's almost double what we spend on Social Security. It's way more than what we spend to educate 52 million children around the country. And it's about enough to, you could fund the entire budget of the EPA on what we spend on fossil fuels every 2.5 days, an entire year's activities for the EPA. So it's important to understand, this is tough. We're up against a well-funded, the most politically influential industry in the history of the world. What we're trying to do is tell people three things. Number one, this is a problem. In fact, it's a central environmental problem of our time. We have an obligation to protect future generations from the hazards of climate change. Number two, there is a fix. We can invest in energy efficiency so that we do more with less waste. We can build more wind, solar, and other types of renewable power. And we can build the next generation of energy-efficient cars, homes, and workplaces in this country. And three, by doing so, we will make our country stronger, our economy more secure, and our children healthier. That's a good message. We use every engine of persuasion at our disposal to try to get that message out there, and we'll continue to do so.
Francis, you spoke highly of President Obama's climate plan unveiled on that hot day in Washington when you were present. And this questioner wants you to share your thoughts on his repeated references to an all-of-the-above energy policy and his enthusiasm for domestic oil and gas production.
So that's a very complicated issue, and it's distressing to us. It's distressing to the environmental community because even though we do have an oil addiction, we have to transfer to clean energy. And assuming that it's all of the above and we continue forging ahead, I think is very, very problematic. It's also very problematic that with the abundance of oil and gas that we have and the low price, that the price is really undercutting the alternatives. I mean, to me, the most discouraging thing is that the abundance of gas undercuts renewables, less so because they're getting more competitive. But I thought, 4 or 5 years ago, we were further ahead where the price was a lot higher. So that's very troubling. And, it's just very clear that this administration will not change their view on the all of the above, that the fracking boom has been, coming from his election in 2008 when the economy was in terrible shape. It's benefited the economy in a way that they feel is very, very important. Our challenge is to put clean energy solutions policies in place to make them competitive and to really be strong advocates with the administration or focused on the administration so they really understand what the environmental implications of the fossil fuel appetite are and hold them accountable for that. So that's, we're embracing the climate action plan. We're working very hard on it. But we are very strong advocates to protect the environment from fossil fuel development, and we're not going to shy away from that.
An Australian visitor irresistibly, from my perspective, quotes Dr. Arthur Rosenfeld, California hero well known to many in this room, and points out, and I do remember this, that Dr. Rosenfeld once told a U.S. Senate subcommittee on energy, and this is pretty much an exact quote, "We have a 20-year goal divided into 5-year plans administered by 2-year elected officials under uncertain 1-year budgets." And the question from our Australian friend is, does democracy increase or decrease hope?
So travel with me to Beijing sometime where, you can say, when they want to do something, they do it. They don't have all this messy system. But on the other hand, who would... very difficult to live there, incredibly polluted, toxic, really, in many respects. So I go with democracy. But I do think that one of the big challenges we in the environmental community have is that we're long-term thinkers. The issues that we're working on are really long-term issues. And as Art Rosenfeld says so clearly, both the private sector, which works on quarterly statements and annual reports, and the political sector, which works on 2, 4, or 6-year election cycles, it's all very short-term. And bringing together the the long-term goals of, in our area, the environmental community, but in a lot of other civil society issues, much more longer-term issues, aligning that with the short-term nature of our economic political system, I think is one of the huge challenges of our time. I mean, it's just troubled me for many, many years. I just find it very difficult to pull those things together. And I think that, you know, science matters hugely. You know, I look back at the Montreal Protocol, chlorofluorocarbons, the ozone hole. That was a really good news story. We were very involved in it. When the science was so overpowering, the nations came together and adopted an agreement that actually shifted and really addressed the problem in a very significant way. And I think if you go to other parts of the world, the climate conversation is a very real conversation. They're not besieged with the denier factor. You know, if you go to India, you go to China, where they already have tremendous water shortages, or India, where 400 million people don't have energy, and they're, you know, looking at huge water shortages coming out of the Himalayas. These are very real issues. They have immediate needs, economic needs for their populations, and trying to align how to deliver services, benefits, well-being, really, health and well-being to their population, while being very cognizant of these long-term threats that they have. You know, they're talking about it, they're thinking about it, they're not arguing about it the way we are. So, you know, I mean, I have to believe that we will get over this period. I hope sooner rather than later, but during this election cycle, it doesn't look that promising.
I think I have time for two more questions. Bob, I have one here that I know is for you, and then I'm going to shift back to Francis. The one for you, you spoke glowingly of an economic future dominated by clean energy. But there are a lot of people employed in the energy present that we're transitioning away from, and they are scared. And coal miners in particular are identified. And the question is, what about them? What will you say to them?
Well, I think I'd say to them, in part, the answer to your first question, which is when you're on the right side of history, government by the consent of the governed is pretty hard to beat. And I think for the people in West Virginia, the people of Kentucky, the opportunities are manifestly more promising in the clean energy future than they are in coal mining. Look, we had 700,000 coal miners in this country at one point, but that was a long, long time ago. That was decades ago. Right now, we have 80,000 coal miners in this country. Now, every one of those jobs is important. We have 200,000 people who get up every day and build wind turbines and solar electric facilities. Those jobs are important, too. Those jobs are our future, and some of those jobs are in West Virginia, where that whole eastern plateau of West Virginia has wind turbines on it, where the community college in that part of West Virginia has a wind turbine maintenance certification program that is oversubscribed, and where the manufacturing center at the University of West Virginia is working to build the most efficient manufacturing techniques and processes anywhere in the history of the world so that our workers are more competitive at home and abroad. That's the future. That's what I would say to those folks.
And Francis, a question for you, drawing again on the title of the book, which is, how much time do we have left to make the critical changes that you are calling for?
So we don't have a lot of time, and you know, I was reading yesterday about a study that just came out on sort of the psychological well-being of the science community, and that the climate scientists are just a very, very distressed bunch. I you know, we work with them all the time. They are so alarmed that the action that's necessary is not being taken and the change is happening so quickly. So we don't have time. On the other hand, we have to work as hard as we can to get in place the various policies and steps to move and accelerate towards clean energy. So I personally, I am very alarmed by the direction we're going in and by the scientific evidence. But what I and NRDC are trying to do is to put every piece in place that we can and engage a broader public to accelerate the change. There will be a lot of change. We are not avoiding the changes that will come with climate change. We have to work to avoid the worst impacts and to unleash the most promising strategies as quickly as possible. But, you know, we live in a government system. That's what we have to do. You know, you have to get up every morning and do the best job that you can. And NRDC has 480 people working on these things, over 100 plus, even more, I'm sure Ralph would tell me, working on clean energy. And, you know, I'm just incredibly motivated and proud by what each of these individuals is doing, because, you know, I wish we had twice as many people to do this, and, you know, hopefully at some point we will. But, you know, we're doing the best job we can on the most important issue, and we will do more. And that's what I ask for everybody in this room to do, because that's what it takes. It takes real determination and commitment to put in place the strategies that make the change. And it only happens with people making the commitment to do it. So, you know, I'm very focused on the doing. And fortunately, that prevents me from wringing my hands too much, because I don't have time to do that, which I'm happy about. Because, you know, if you spend a lot of time, and, you know, I know a lot of people who do read the literature on a regular basis, and it is very, very distressing. But the only alternative to that is to take action and put in place solutions, and so that's what I do.
Anne has graciously granted me one more question, and so I'm going to merge several, which point out that over the course of the history of the environmental community, there's often a lively debate between the relative balance between direct regulation of a pollutant and a market-based solution that prices it and relies on ingenuity to find the lowest cost alternative. And the specific question, and Bob, I think I'll start this one with you because I know it's come up from time to time in your interviews. In the specific context of carbon regulation, the balance between putting enforceable limits on carbon emissions and taxing carbon, where do you come out? What's the right way to resolve that?
Well, NRDC doesn't have a formal position on it, except that what we have said is that there needs to be some realistic assessment of where you place the cost of carbon. It's not as though there isn't a cost to carbon right now. We're all paying that cost every single day, and the whole point of this book is to show just how much that is. What's not happening is that cost is not being tied directly to the consumers and the producers of the energy. It is instead being spread out among across the economy willy-nilly. So we feel that to rationalize that in some way is essential to moving forward. And let me show you where, just to tell you really quickly, where the market is working right now. Right now, every day in the United States, there are 3.4 million Americans who get up every single day, suit up, roll up their sleeves, and go to work building the energy future of tomorrow, whether it's the efficiency gains that have actually cut our energy use in half as a percentage of our economic output over just the last 35 years. That is an extraordinary triumph of the American economy and of the American market. We are getting now, the first 6 months of this year, 5.5% of our electricity nationally from wind turbines, 5.5%. Now, that's a good start. We can be getting 15% within 15 years. The DOD has said we believe we can do even better than that aspirationally. You look at Texas, the oil capital of the world is getting 8% of its electricity from wind turbines, and those turbines are helping to keep the family ranch and farm viable. So we're seeing success across this economy. We're not hearing about it because, as we said earlier, the fossil fuel industry is trying to drown out those voices. But we're going to be out there continuing to tell the story, and we're going to look to people to tell their own story as well. Francis.
Anne. I mean, it's hard to follow, Bob. This is why, now you know why communications is such an important part of this, because
there's a good news story
to tell, and he knows how to tell it.
Francis, I'm sorry to interrupt you there. This has, as you said, been a wonderful discussion tonight, and really a great deal of information and laughter, which is always nice when we're dealing even with such difficult questions. So unfortunately, we have reached our point in the program for us to thank Frances Beinecke, President of the Natural Resources Defense Council. She's in conversation with Bob Deans, former president of the White House Correspondents Association and currently director of editorial content of NRDC, and our excellent moderator tonight, Ralph Cavanaugh, who's co-director of NRDC's energy program. A big thank you and a big round of applause. Oh, I should tell you this before you applaud. I was asked to remind everyone that we do have a reception immediately following our program and a book signing by Francis. So there are books here in the room, and if you wish Francis to sign, grab one of those books. They're also extra books. So don't forget a reception immediately following this presentation tonight. The reception is follow that gentleman. That will get you where you need to go. So again, a big thanks to you, to Francis, Bob, and Ralph. A big thanks to our audience here today and our radio and internet audiences. And our special thanks to Kevin O'Malley, who's chair of the Business and Leadership Member-Led Forum. Look for all of the Commonwealth Club programs at www.commonwealthclub.org and check out our radio, video, and free streaming podcasts. Remember, you can find our programs on radio, video, and podcasts and watch programs on the California Channel Thursdays at 9 p.m. and on KRCB-TV Channel 22 on Comcast and DirecTV at 11 a.m. the last Sunday of each month. Subscribe to our free podcasting service to automatically download a program recording to your personal computer each week. To do this, go to commonwealthclub.org/podcast. Don't forget our green announcements and our November New Visions for the Environment programs. I'm Ann Clark, chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 111 years of enlightened discussion, and tonight is really one of those top programs in which we've had a great deal of wonderful enlightened discussion, In the Know, is adjourned.